So tonight, I'm going to talk about going inward, the idea of inner retreat. This is inspired by the fact, first of all, that last week we had the autumnal equinox, and now nights are longer than the days, and there's this natural introspective movement during this time. Also, this Wednesday is the Christian feast of Michaelmas, feast of St. Michael, who's often seen as a kind of protector standing guard over this entrance into the dark time of the year. And it's funny, the whole phrase going inward, I think in our very head-centric culture, so many people would think of going inward as just going into their thoughts, you know, and it's so much more than that.
Yes.
So I'm going to... unfortunately, I apologize. This would be the one night that I forgot to put the quote sheet on a Google sheet. But I'm going to talk about a couple poems, and I'll post the poems at least. So first of all, let me share the quote sheet with Adam.
Oh, Brian.
Thank you.
And I believe this is a link to the first poem, Sweet Darkness by David White. So I just dropped that in the chat. So first I'll just read this poem. When your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. When your vision has gone, no part of the world can find you. Time to go into the dark where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There you can be sure you are not beyond love. The dark will be your home tonight. The night will give you a horizon further than you can see. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. Give up all the other worlds except the one to which you belong. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. So a few things I want to say about that. First of all, I love that opening line. When your eyes are tired, the world is tired too. There's a quality of fierce attention that brings the world alive when we're really paying attention. And when we're not paying attention, the world gets kind of flat and dull. And I think it's very easy to get into this place of not recognizing our own responsibility and just thinking, oh, the world is flat and dull. What a horrible world, you know, like that kind of thing. Not realizing how much we're complicit in our experience of how vital the world is. And I also like the whole thing about time to go into the dark where night has eyes to recognize its own. The dark will be your home tonight. The night will give you a horizon further than you see. This whole idea of entering into the unknown. Healing is about entering into the unknown. Spiritual growth is about entering into the unknown. The unknown makes us uncomfortable because we don't control it, you know? And when we're faced with the unknown, we do all kinds of mental acrobatics. You know, we try and imagine it and fill it with our fears or fill it with our fantasies or that sort of thing, rather than simply be with the unknown. And that unknown is both the unknown outside of us as well as the unknown within us, the unknown of where the healing process will go, where our spiritual growth will go. You know, I am not in the driver's seat of my spiritual growth, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, that amazing line, the world was made to be free in. And freedom is such an interesting idea. You know, of course, ego loves to hear that. You know, oh boy, I'm free. I get to do what I want, you know. And I think if we ask most Americans, just stop people on the street, what does freedom mean? I think most people's reflexive response means freedom means I can do what I want. And it's funny because on reflection, what I want is not a solid basis for freedom. What I want is not even a solid basis for happiness, you know? Freedom is something much different. Freedom is, first of all, inner spaciousness. Freedom is that place of equanimity. You know, the Buddha, on the night of his when he was about to achieve enlightenment, he was tempted by Mara. And the three temptations were fear, desire, and social duty, you know? And so we're in a place of equanimity where we're not feeling the pull of fear, desire, and social duty. There's freedom in that place. And part of freedom is also stepping into our power. You know, there's that famous Marianne Williamson quote. It's not on the quote sheet, but I'm sure you're familiar with it. Our deepest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. And I heard that quote decades ago, and I've really been pondering for a long time why would it be our deepest fear that we're powerful beyond measure? And it's interesting because I think, there's so many ways that victim narratives and self-pity are things that ego can use to its advantage. You know, they're almost like these get out of jail free cards that ego has, you know, because they serve as perfect excuses for any kind of indulgence, any kind of failure, you know. Well, this pleasure, you know I shouldn't indulge with it, but I've had a rough time. I can't help it, you know. I'm going to indulge. Or, you know, the way I treated that person, maybe it wasn't as noble as I should have, but I couldn't help it. I'm going through a lot, you know, like this sort of thing. Ego loves having self-pity or victim narratives in its back pocket to pull out as these get-out-of-jail-free excuses for whatever it wants to get away with. You know, when we're in our power, really stepping fully into our power means giving all that up. Really, really stepping into our power means no more victim narrative, no more self-pity, just taking responsibility for what we do, you know. And so, you know, ego thinks that power sounds like a really good thing until it realizes everything that would be given up. And that final line, anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. I've also heard David White, when he's reciting the poem, sometimes he'll recite it as is, and then I'll recite those last lines again as, anything or anyone that does not bring you alive, you have made too small for you, you know. And it's always this interesting thing, you know. First of all, yes, there are conversations that are too small for us and sometimes we need to walk away. There are situations that are too small for us and sometimes we need to walk away. It's always trickier in a relationship, in a friendship, in any kind of relationship. Is it that the other person truly is too small for me, or is it that I've put them in a box and made them small, you know? And so that's always an interesting dance. But it always is a good question, what brings me alive? You know, what in my life right now brings me alive? What about my hopes? What about my plans brings me alive? You know? And is enough of my current life something that brings me alive? You know? So that's the first poem, and I wanted to juxtapose that with another poem. And this other poem is, I have to get back to the web to get a copy of this. The other passage is from the Four Quartets. And so First of all, I'll post. This is the entire Burton Norton, the first of the four quartets. So I'm not going to talk about the whole thing. Let's see. What is a sensible way to do this? If you search by the text, if you do find and search by the lines that begin Descend Lower, and I think you'll get down to this short passage that I'm going to talk about. Descend Lower, Descend Only. So give me a thumbs up when you, people on Zoom, when you found that passage. Okay. All right, so I'll read this. Well, first I'll just read it through. Descend lower, descend only into the world of perpetual solitude, world not world, that which is not world, internal darkness, deprivation and destitution of all property, desiccation of the world of sense, evacuation of the world of fantasy, inoperancy of the world of spirit. This is the one way, and the other is the same. Not in movement, but abstention from movement, while the world moves in appetency, in its meddled ways of time past and time future. So the first thing I'll say is that T.S. Eliot is not quite as user-friendly as David White. This requires a little more explaining, this passage. It's also about going inward, descend lower, descend into the world of perpetual solitude. And that's a fascinating idea, perpetual solitude, you know, the place where we are always alone. The place where I am alone with my own experience, you know? And it can be framed as this loneliness, but there's also something incredibly authentic about it, you know? What is my own experience? And being alone with that, you know? There's not necessarily a lot of room in this culture, or as it were, permission in this culture to occupy that kind of space. And I love the lines, world not world, that which is not world. Especially if we've been engaged in the external world for a long time, when we start going inward, it's topsy-turvy. It's suddenly everything that was making sense out in the world doesn't make sense anymore, you know? And even if we've been doing this work for a while, there can come these points where suddenly, because something shifts inside, and suddenly nothing makes sense anymore the way that it used to make sense, you know? And so it's, it's about suddenly being in a place that is not recognizable as the world anymore. So then he has these lines, internal darkness, deprivation, and destitution of all property. Destitution, we get the word destitute, someone who's poor. So this whole idea of property being taken away. And certainly it's true that, you know, any of our, any of the objects that we own are not going to be particularly helpful to us when we're going through our internal journey. But more than that, anything about our status, anything about, you know, what rank or power or what image we have in the world, what we think the world owes to us, like all of that, we have to let go of that when we go inward. There's this wonderful Zen story about Katagari, who was the governor of Kyoto. He was good friends with a monk, and so at one point he paid on the monk, and he presented his card, Katagori, governor of Kyoto. The attendant brought it to the Zen master. The Zen master looked at it and says, I have no idea who this person is. Send them away. And the attendant brings the card out, and Katagori says, oh, my mistake. And he crosses out governor of Kyoto and just has his name. Brings it back to the Zen master. Oh, Katagori, he's my friend. Invite him in. You know, this whole idea that we hide behind our ranks. We hide behind our offices, you know. And even all that stuff about, you know, I've been doing spiritual work for X number of years. I shouldn't have to deal with, or I should be beyond such and such. Like, even that we have to let go of. Like, that's all part of the deprivation and destitution. We have to let go of all of that, you know. It's the spiritual path and the healing journey always call for the beginner mind, you know. And whatever is challenging right now is going to be challenging right now, regardless of my story about whether I should be beyond it or not. And then this wonderful triplet, desiccation of the world of sense. Desiccation is drying out. Drying out of the world of sensory experience. And this is something subtle and not often, I haven't heard this actually discussed in too many circles, but the whole idea of visual energy. We have visual energy. In fact, we're enormously visual creatures as humans. When I'm looking at something with desire, when I'm looking at something, boy, I want to have that, energy is spilling out of my eyes. I'm losing visual energy. Whereas I'm in a place of purely appreciating, taking in a sunset, taking in a beautiful tree, something like that, then there's energy coming into my eyes, you know? And I've heard some mystics talk about how we don't realize how much energy we lose through our eyes, you know? And so it's a funny thing just to monitor and just to play with, you know? When is the energy coming in? When is the energy coming out? You know, this whole idea of drying out of the world of sense, of really letting ourselves get carried away, you know, ogling at, you know, things outside of us or, you know, intoxicated with our senses. The second one, evacuation of the world of fancy, that's really the world of fantasy, you know, clearing out the whole world of fantasy, you know, how much energy do we put into fantasy? How much energy do we put into wild daydreams, into plans about how it's going to be better someday when X, Y, and Z are true? You know, all that emotional energy goes. And for the most part, that's emotional energy that's wasted. We have that emotional energy in the fantasy, and then that emotional energy is gone, you know? And so again, it's this other reserve of energy, you know? Not losing energy through the eyes, not losing the energy, frittering it away through fantasy. And then the final one, which in some ways is the hardest one, inoperancy of the world of spirit. Inoperancy simply means not operating, not working. When we've been doing spiritual work for a while, we develop this sense of how spiritual work should feel, how healing work should feel, you know? We might get very comfortable with the way that my spiritual work is going, you know? And then we hit a certain point, and at a certain point, part of the healing process is that the way that my spiritual work feels, the way that it feels good, doesn't feel good anymore, you know? The way that it seemed to be working doesn't work anymore, you know? And that there's this breakdown of even my desires, even my sense of what it is to be a spiritual person, a breakdown of even my ideas of what spiritual practice should look like or feel like. And that it's such a radical, Eliot is talking about such a radical simplification that even that needs to be simplified. For years, I was part of a meditation group, and one of the terms that this group used for this the inoperancy of the world of spirit was aridity, a time when suddenly everything feels dry. You're meditating, and it just feels you're not feeling the juice anymore. It just feels dry day after day. And of course, someone who is maybe not as experienced in meditation, maybe they try it for a little while, they hit that period and they say, oh, it's not working anymore, and they give it up, you know? Whereas the teaching of this group was, when we hit the aridity, it's so important to stick with it. It's so important to just sit day after day in the not workingness, in the dryness, you know, and just move through it. And that the richness comes from moving through the aridity over and over again. And so it's a, how can I say, it's a, Mr. Eliot is holding up a very high bar in this passage. And then finally, he just says, this is the one way and the other is the same, not in movement, but abstention from movement. And that's fascinating. You know, and certainly to some extent, it's about outward stillness, you know. But it's much more about inner movements, you know. What does it mean to truly abstain from inner movement? Thought is a movement, emotion is a movement, fantasy is a movement. What does it mean really to come to profound inner stillness? You know, and to some extent, that is the very state of that Buddhism extols, you know, the place of being, you know, still where there's not a single leaf stirring, that kind of thing. And then finally, world moves in appetency. Appetency, that's just appetite, desire. The world moves in desire on its metal ways of time past and time future. And I love that image. It's almost like the train track of desire, you know. Gotta have more, gotta have the best, gotta have the new. You know, the world is on this train track and our movement is just such a different movement, you know, looking for this point of complete stillness within. So that's what David White and Mr. Eliot have to say about going inward. And I have some more quotes on the quote sheet. And unfortunately, I don't have an easy way to share these right now. I'll read them. And then later when I post the quote, post the talk, you'll have the whole quote sheet then. But Master Dogen, this great Zen master, said, "Cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words, and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inward to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest." This whole idea of the backward step, stepping back from the world I'm experiencing to experience the self that is having the experience of the world. A quote from Rumi: "Be passionate for the friend's tyranny, not his tenderness, so the arrogant beauty in you can become a lover that weeps." Very much pointing to all the deprivation, the desiccation, the inopercy in T.S. Eliot's writing. Not fun stuff to face necessarily, but I love that image of, you know, be passionate for the tyranny, not the tenderness, so the arrogant beauty in you can become a lover that weeps. A couple from Carl Jung. Carl Jung said, "Your visions will become clear only when you can look into your own heart. Whoever looks outside dreams, whoever looks inside awakes." And Jung also said, "We must be able to let things happen in the psyche. For us, this is actually the art of which few people know anything. Consciousness is forever interfering, helping, correcting, negating, and never simply leaving the growth process of the psyche in peace. It would be simple enough if only simplicity were not the most difficult of things." A famous one from Rilke: "The purpose of life is to be defeated by greater and greater things." Again, very simply, the purpose of life is to be defeated by greater and greater things. Hermann Hesse said, "Each man has only one vocation, to find a way to himself. His task was to discover his own destiny, not an arbitrary one, and to live it out wholly and resolutely within himself. Everything else was only a would-be existence, an attempt at evasion, a flight backwards to the ideals of the masses, conformity, and fear of one's own inwardness." D.H. Lawrence says, "It is a question practically of relationship. We must get back into relation, vivid and nourishing relation to the cosmos and the universe. For the truth is, we are perishing for the lack of fulfillment of our greater needs. And we are cut off from the great sources of our inward nourishment and renewal, sources which flow eternally in the universe. Vitally, the human race is dying. It is like a great uprooted tree with its roots in the air. We must plant ourselves again in the universe. Henry Miller said quite simply, if you have not found heaven within, it is a certainty you will not find it without. Tara Brach says, call on your natural curiosity as you focus inward. Try to let go of any preconceived ideas and instead listen in a kind, receptive way to your body and heart. Adi Ashanti said, all that is necessary to awaken yourself as the radiant emptiness of spirit is to stop seeking something more or better or different. Again, the meddled ways of appetency. And to turn your attention inward to the awake silence that you are. I love that phrase, the awake silence that you are. And finally, from Vera Nazarian, the desert and the ocean are realms of desolation on the surface. The desert is a place of bones where inwards are turned out to desiccate into dust. The ocean is a place of skin, rich outer membranes hiding thick, juicy insides laden with the soup of being. Both worlds are deceptive, dangerous, both seething with life, hidden life. The only veil that stands between perception of what is underneath and underneath the desolate surface is your courage. Dare to breach the surface and sink.